All right, good afternoon. Today is Tuesday, April 15th, 2008. My name is Allison Page, and I'm with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Archives Oral History Program. And today I will be interviewing John Clunas about his remembrances with the Forest Products Lab. Mr. Clunas, if you would like to start off with just briefly describing your childhood, your academic background, and kind of what led you into the Forest Products Lab?
Okay, well, you know, I think I began to have an interest in forestry and the forest products industry, of course, when I was 14 years old, back in 1947, I got to go logging with my grandfather in Norway. Both my parents were Norwegian immigrants who met in this country, and I was the firstborn. And I got, my mother took us back, me and my two younger brothers, to visit her parents in Norway after the Second World War. And while I was there a whole winter, and went to school there and everything. But my grandfather was a logger, and I got to go logging with him, and that experience gave me sort of a love for logging and forestry and the type of self-reliance and work ethic that you develop when you're a logger, and the respect for the forest, of course. And later, I enrolled in chemical engineering at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and got a bachelor's degree. And after that, I went to work for the Northwest Paper Company, which subsequently became Potlatch. And I worked 4 years as and I worked for them because they were to do with forestry, really, and I wanted to have some connection with forestry. So I worked for a paper mill. I worked 4 years in Brainerd, Minnesota, as a technical service engineer, and then I was transferred to Cloquet for 3 years. And I worked in the coating research lab there. I was a coating research engineer. And after that, I came to Madison and worked for a short while, less than 2 years, for Rayovac. And then I have saw the opportunity to get a job at the Forest Products Laboratory in 1970, which I worked until I retired in 1974, I believe it was. I've been retired for 2 years, so it must have been 75, I believe, was when I retired.
Okay. And you said you came to FPL in 1970, was that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And did you have any previous education? I may have missed that. What degrees you had, or...
I had a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from the University of Wisconsin, and then I worked for 7 years in the paper industry, which was really an education as well. And then I came to work at the Forest Products Laboratory, and they were glad to get me because I had industrial experience, both hands-on and in manufacturing and in research for a paper mill.
Okay. How did you learn about the Forest Products Lab, and what were your initial impressions about the...
Well, I had to do a paper for one of my courses in chemical engineering, and I did it on what direction the paper industry should take, and the conclusion of my paper was that they should put more effort into using high yield pulp, which is essentially 100% yield, versus chemical pulp, which only gets 50% yield. But in order to talk about the paper industry, I had to go to the Forest Products Laboratory because they had a library there, and I did most of my research with a little paper that I wrote, but that was my first contact with the Forest Products Laboratory, and I was quite impressed that they were doing such basic and fundamental research, and so my first impression was very favorable.
Okay. Well, I guess we could start with when you came to Forest Products Lab in 1970, could you describe maybe your first days on the job and the division that you worked in, the people that you worked under?
Well, I was hired, and I was amazed at how quickly it went. I applied for the job, and within a month I started working. I guess there was a lot less paperwork then. At the time, there was about 420 people, permanent full-time people, working at the laboratory versus the 120 or so now. And they had just built some new additions in just 2 years prior to that, and the mood at FPL was very upbeat. At that time, the Forest Service was cutting timber and selling it and giving money after all their expenses back to the U.S. Treasury. So money wasn't really a big problem. And I only had one requirement, is that I should publish a single author paper once a year. And that, you know, was more or less self-directed, and as long as I met the missions of the laboratory and the missions of the work unit that I was working in. And I was working in a process development unit. The laboratory was broken down into three different areas. There was solid wood, and there was panel products and pulp and paper. I was in pulp and paper, and I was in the process development portion of that. And I started out working in recycling waste paper and how to clean it up and how to bleach it and how to make it stronger, etc. At that time, as I said, the only requirement is that we publish one paper. But subsequently, the Forest Service, the cutting on federal lands was greatly curtailed, and due to the environmental problems, environmentalists, and so the Forest Service had to ask the government for money, and then our budget became sort of static, and because of inflation, there had to be a reduction in the workforce, and we had to do more. And then we were allowed to work as teams so that we could publish more papers. The aggregate went up when you worked as a team because it was much more effective. And that we were not encouraged to go after soft money, go after grants, because initially, if you'd hire people, they would work just temporarily, and they usually worked out to be very good workers. But then you'd have to let them go, which was very traumatic after the soft money dried up. But because our budget was being curtailed, we were allowed to hire people, you know, postdocs and things like that, to help us with our research. And so my job began to change from writing a study plan and performing the experiments and writing a paper and publishing it and presenting it at a conference, say, and then starting it all over again with the next project. And now I began slowly to begin to write for grants and getting grant money and then hiring people to do the work and then writing up the results of that. And so I began getting a team and being the leader of a team that just worked together, and I would apply for the grants and write up the results, and I'd hire people to do the experiments. That seemed to be the most efficient way for me to keep going, and that's the way I eventually ended up. That was the type of work that I was doing. I was sort of a team leader, and the money for the team, I got that from writing grants, and I would hire people just on a sort of a temporary basis. And they came on board, and they hoped that they would become full-time employees, which a lot of them did. They just had to wait around a lot longer than they did when I started. There was some travel then. As I started, I think my first paper was written, and I had to present that at a conference. And I did that in the early 70s in Boston. I can remember it very clearly. And then I began presenting papers two or three times a year and going to conferences, and not only going to conferences in this country, but in Canada and Mexico and many countries in Europe. And it was very exciting for me at first, but after about 15 or 20 years, it began became routine, and I was amazed at how blasé I became about visiting foreign countries.
Mm-hmm. In general, what was the reception like when you went to these meetings?
Oh, it was really. We were required to give a paper if we were going to a conference, and giving a paper was such a good way to introduce yourself to the attendees. And you know, if I could give a paper early in the conference, then all the attendees felt like they knew me, because I had the people that attended my session would feel like they knew about what I was doing and my work, and it was very friendly. The people just it was a way to network, and they'd tell me about what they were doing, and I would get people interested, and some people would even collaborate with me or fund some of my research. So it was really a positive experience. It becomes a little bit like a rock star, you know, when you get your people who are your fans and listen and come every chance they can to see what you've done recently, you know, keep up with your work. So it was a lot of fun for me. It was really it was like an ego trip, really.
So would you say that most of your work at Forest Products Lab was mostly research-based, like in-lab kind of work, or writing?
Well, the type of work that I was doing was process development. And typically we would do some development work, some research work, and publish a paper on it. And, you know, after we presented it at a conference, we'd publish it in a peer-reviewed journal. And then we'd go on to the next one. And as the scientists and engineers that I knew at the laboratory, especially my unit or related units, you know, process development, as they approached retirement, I'd say, well, you know, how did you like your career? Did you have any regrets about it and everything? And they all gave me about the same answer. They said they really loved the freedom of the lab. They liked the mission of the lab. They liked the freedom of being self-directed to researchers. And that was very much a plus for them, and so they could you know, utilize their own strengths. But one thing they all complained about was that there was never any technology transfer. What they worked on was never picked up by the industry, and that was really a regret that almost everybody heard of. Everybody talked about, but I felt that a couple of my projects were really picked up by the industry, and I felt really especially good about it. There was one enzyme enhanced de-inking, where we used enzymes to enhance the removal of toners and also stickies, which were a real big problem in recycled paper. And it was very environmentally friendly and very effective, and it resulted in the startup of a company that they were called Enzyme De-Inking Technologies, and they were a going concern. And they employed, I don't know, there was 20 or 30 people, and they had their headquarters in Atlanta, and they freely admitted that the research that we did, and it was a team that I had was the head of. They freely admitted that they owed their success to the technology that we developed. Of course, they changed that technology as they became more knowledgeable and as they did more work. But it was something that was transferred from the laboratory, and it did help. the paper making hasn't really changed in the last 50, 75 years. If you divide up the paper industry into pulping and paper making, pulping is a chemical process and there's been a lot of changes in the type of pulping and how they pulp and how they recover the chemicals and their bleaching processes. I would say also that's a sort of like a pulping process. But in paper making, there really hasn't been that many changes. And in paper making, the big thing is to get the you form a pulp slurry, and then you form a web on the paper machine, and then you've got to get the water out. And first you drain it, which is very economical, and then it costs a little more to press it mechanically. And the most expensive thing is to dry the paper. Now, typically a paper machine will have 100 steam-filled steel drums to dry the paper, and this process will do several different things. It can reduce the number of drums that are required from about 100 down to about 30, so that there's a big savings there. Not only do you save energy, but you save construction costs, and you save on the number, on the size of the building that you need for it. And also, it uses more filler than fiber, and filler only costs like 20% of what the fiber does. So typically for 100, say, 1,000-ton per day mill, if you can go up 1% in calcium carbonate versus pulp fiber, you'll save $1 million a year. That was kind of like a rule of thumb. And fiber loading, you can go several percentage points higher. So that's the second way. You can use more low-cost raw materials. And the third way is that you can make these filler, calcium carbonate is what I'm talking about, you can make it more cheaper in this process than the most economical processes used today. And I'll just now back up and tell you a little bit what the process is. In the most efficient way for making calcium carbonate or paper mill is to have a satellite mill, a satellite calcium carbonate mill. And they have two tanks typically. One, they'll ship in a calcium oxide into and they'll dump it into a tank filled with water, and they'll call that slaking quick lime. And so it goes from calcium oxide then to calcium hydroxide. Just through that reaction, it gives off a lot of heat, and it's a somewhat uncontrolled reaction. And then they'll pump that calcium hydroxide into a second tank and add CO2, and that CO2 typically will be captured from stack gas at the paper mill, and they'll mix that CO2 and the calcium hydroxide in a water solution, and then you form calcium carbonate, and that calcium carbonate is pumped over to the mill and used as a filler. It's a very bright chemical. It's got like 100 brightness, and people like it very much. It gives a very good, and the more filler you can use in paper, the better the formation, the more uniform formation you have, and the cheaper the raw materials, and the easier it is to dewater, because calcium carbonate does not hang on to water like fiber does, so everybody would like to use more of it. Well, we've come up with a process that can be used in the stock prep system. And here, you create calcium carbonate, but you do it in a pressurized refiner. And a pressurized refiner is just a mechanical device, typically with two counter-rotating disks, and they put it under pressure. They put it typically under steam pressure. But you can add calcium hydroxide. Step one, you mix it with the pulp. And step two, you put it through a conventional pressurized refiner, which are very common in paper mills. And instead of having steam, you have CO2, and that creates calcium carbonate in the process itself. And the beautiful thing about that is the calcium hydroxide is so attracted to the fiber that it goes within the cell wall and into the lumen. And when you mix it with CO2, Another thing is that this dewaters so much better. It dewaters better than a similar conventionally loaded or direct loaded paper at the same filler level, so that you can put in more. And we've had some indications, and I retired before we were able really to pin it down, but what it looks like is that this displaces some very difficult to remove water. Now, for example, if you take a very, very efficient centrifuge and take a pulp slurry and you centrifuge until you can't get any more water out, this is what they call the fiber saturation point. Now, there's water, there's free water in a pulp slurry, and there's bound water. And so typically this is at like 71% solids, and that's the fiber saturation point. You can't take out any more water. There's no more free water. The rest of it is bound water. Now, the bound water is divided into two different types. There's the freezing bound water and the non-freezing bound water. And the surface area inside of a pulp, a typical pulp, 98% of the surface area is within really tiny pores that are 4 nanometers or less in diameter. And those water molecules are bound chemically to carboxyl groups and hydroxyl groups in the pulp itself, and there's so little room for movement for the water that this water will not freeze. And also, it has a higher specific heat. You can't drain it out. You can't really press it out very well because it's so tightly bound inside the fiber. And also, it takes more to dry it. Now, what fraction is non-freezing and which is freezing? I'm not quite sure, but you know, it could be like 50-50. So you've got at least like 15% of the water that is very, very difficult to remove. And there's methods for measuring freezing and non-freezing water. And the fiber-loaded pulps, these experiments have to be repeated, but we have indications that the calcium hydroxide, because of its chemical formation and chemical structure, is very attractive to the carboxyl groups and the OH groups inside the fiber, and displaces that water and forms bonds with the carboxyl groups and hydroxyl groups inside the fiber. And that makes the fiber much easier to drain, much easier to press, and much easier to dry, so you have a tremendous savings in energy. So you have three ways to save, and it's very economical. This would be a real fundamental change in paper making, and it's being, as we speak, the equipment is being manufactured by Voith Manufacturing Company, Voith in Germany, and it's going to be installed by about June 1st. And if that is successful, even partially successful, if that meets even part of what our expectations are, this will surely be adopted by mills worldwide, and it will be a big thing for the laboratory. Now, I know that it's a truism that inventors do not get rich over their inventions, and I didn't really expect that. We have a patent which has been licensed to Voith. When that patent was taken out in 1993, so there's only a couple years remaining, and I'm sure that there will be no profit on this until that patent expires. But the second thing, which is also sort of a truism, is that the inventors don't really get credit for what they've done. But the laboratory and the team that I worked with has published so many papers. We've published at least, 40 papers and presented this over the years. And so I think that it's going to be inevitable that the laboratory will get credit for what we've done. I hope so, because it's a good thing for the laboratory. It gives us a leg up on when we ask for funds from Congress, because they say, what have you done for us? And we can say, well, we've been a big help to the Forest Service. And we could really help. The paper industry is dying in this country, in the United States. And it's because, I think, mainly because haven't really invested in the most modern equipment like we should. Scandinavia, on the other hand, has a worse climate for growing trees than we do up in the upper Midwest here, but yet their paper industry is thriving. The paper industry is a much bigger part of their economy than it is in the United States, and so they've been very careful to keep their paper equipment, their paper and pulp mills, very modernized, and so even though pulp is more expensive over there, they're able to make much more profitably than we are because they haven't kept up. But if we adopt this, I think that that there's a chance we could save a good portion of our industry, and a healthy forest, in my opinion, depends on a healthy forest products industry. In other words, if their trees become valuable, then they can take better care, and they can afford to do more intensive forestry like they do in Europe. And the European and the Scandinavian forests are beautiful, and ours should be too, but they're not really managed like they do over in Europe. And I think there should be more of that done over here. So I think if we can keep the paper mills alive and well in the United States, I think it will help our forests. And I strongly believe that a forest should not just be something you never touch, so that the trees fall over and decay and become a fire hazard and they promote disease and insects and things you don't want. They should be routinely harvested and replanted, and I think that makes a healthy forest. And I hope that this will have an effect on the forests and the paper industry.
Okay. Well, just to clarify, around what year was this project kind of started?
Well, this began and I would say in the late 80s, in 1989 or so, and a man came from Liquid Carbonics. It was a Chicago company, and they were looking for a method to use calcium. They were looking for a process that would use CO2 because they sold CO2. And they interviewed a number of scientists at the laboratory, and when they interviewed me, I told them about this idea, what we could do with that, and they saw immediately the benefit of it, and they funded us for many, many years, and eventually became discouraged, and then we got funding from the DOE, et cetera, and finally, and I got in collaboration with Voith, and we applied for a grant from the DOE, and we got that to build a prototype, and subsequently they sent a doctoral candidate to work with me at the laboratory, Klaus Stolle, and he got his PhD on that topic. And he went over to Voith and sold that idea and educated the people at Voith that the benefits of this, and eventually they licensed this. And if you look up in the U.S. Patent Office and you look at you look under my name, for you look under fiber loading and the laboratory's name or my name, it's been cited by, this was issued in 1993, but there's been 48 patents on fiber loading issued in the U.S. and probably equally or greater number in worldwide. So this has been a seminal patent, and a lot of people have done a lot of research on this topic. So it's opened up a lot of opportunities, and I'll be glad to see this. I'll be overjoyed to see this this used, and I hope the laboratory gets some credit. I can imagine Voith has had a lot of problems with this because when you're sitting in the lab, that's one thing, but when you're out in a paper mill, it's quite another. So they have some very real technical challenges, and I'm sure the technology has been somewhat changed in order to meet the problems that have arisen. But nevertheless, the original idea came from the laboratory, and I do hope that we get some credit for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly sounds as though you got a lot of satisfaction from this one particular job. I was wondering if there was another job or grouping of jobs that gave you a lot of satisfaction.
Well, so as I mentioned before, I started working at the laboratory in recycling, and then it was disbanded after about 10 years or so, but because we have sort of a freedom, the researchers have a freedom to, as long as it goes under the mission of the laboratory, and I always thought that recycling was something that should be maintained. You know, I thought, you know, this really extends the use of our forest resource, and recycling does recycle the waste paper. And so I stuck with it, and I was able to develop this enzyme de-inking technology, which was a very non-chemical way to de-ink, and was very effective and very economical, and it was used. It was used by the paper industry, and that also was, I thought, a real good study. And this was done with a team. There was five or six of us that worked on it, and we never did get any outside funding for that, but the laboratory funded it itself. Fiber loading was mainly done with outside funding. So both projects I thought were very good, but fiber loading was by far the best project that I worked on.
Okay. Well, I guess in contrast to this, was there one job or project that you feel was a particular challenge or drew concerns?
Well, I always felt that basically paper making and stock preparation, you know, really depends on separation processes, and I always thought that we needed to develop a process that depended on different fundamentals, that we would separate things based on size and shape, and we would separate based on wettability by the flotation separation unit, which is really the most effective separation unit in recycling waste paper, because it takes out the non-wettables. But this is a very slow and very touchy process, and I thought that we should we could have done this by a high shear field separation, and we could have had a much faster throughput and a much more effective separation process. And we began this, we called it disk separation, although I think the disk geometry, although it worked very effectively, was not easily to scale up to a larger scale, and we needed to change the geometry of that. But I think someday somebody will do that, but we did. That was not a successful process. We published a lot of papers. There was intense interest in what we were doing, but we never got it to be practical. And I still think it could be practical, but it would just need some more effort. So that's something that, you know, it wasn't, it came before the other two. It was probably, you know, I probably worked on three big projects in my life, and this separation was the first one. And I probably would have done it. I probably would have focused on a different geometry much earlier, while the interest was still strong, and probably would have been more successful.
And that was a project that you worked on in the 70s?
Yeah, I think that was the first real big project, I would say, the late 70s, early 80s. Yeah. I had worked on many small projects before that, but that was my first big project. So, you know, I say I worked on disk separation, I worked on enzyme de-inking, and I also worked on fiber loading. Each one was bigger and more, a bigger project than the last. You know, they kept getting bigger, and the last one I worked on, of course, was the biggest and I think the best project that I worked on.
Well, switching gears a little bit, are there colleagues or people at Forest Products Lab about whom you have strong memories? If so, who are they? And
the man that hired me was Richard Ochter. He's no longer living, but he came to the Forest Products Laboratory after a career in Kimberly-Clark. And I particularly liked him because he insisted that every research project have a practical aspect to it. And I thought that was so important. And I thought that was very, very good. And he also stressed the need for persistence. He said, you know, we don't get anywhere unless we persist in our studies and our projects. And I really think that if you're in research, you really have to learn patience and you have to be persistent. And that's the only way you get through, because you're going to run into technical challenges. There's no question about that. But you just have to keep going. For example, there's a lot of stress on higher degrees, and master's degree and PhD degrees in the sciences. And I know they're important, but there's just as many, if not more, for every person who has an advanced degree, there's probably at least another, or maybe 10 others that are as intelligent and as capable as the people who have the higher degrees. But the people with the higher degrees have demonstrated persistence, and that they have perseverance, and that they will take a hard job to conclusion. Because after all, many of the subjects that you have to take are a little bit on the boring side. You have to have, you have to have really determination to get through them. And so people with higher degrees have demonstrated persistence, and I think that's a real key attribute of any researcher, really, that you have to have persistence.
Mm-hmm.
So Dick Ochter recognized that, and he's a person who I really, I really admired and thought he had quite an influence on me. And the other thing is that when John Erickson was director back in the late 80s or something, he decided that every scientist should be able to visit a laboratory, and he could pick whatever pulp and paper laboratory he wanted. So I picked the PAPRCAN, the Paper Research Institute of Canada in Montreal, and I talked to the researchers there, and the person that really struck me having the best project was Tony Scallon, and he was working on a project, and he called it fiber filling, I believe, and they just took a titanium dioxide and just mechanically mixed it in a slurry with pulp, and then washed away the excess and made paper that was much stronger at a given level of filler. Now, that was the early fiber loading thing, but they didn't have a chemical reaction. They didn't displace any of that non-freezing water. They used a filler that was much more expensive than calcium carbonate, and they had no way to reuse the filler that they screened out, that excess filler that they screened out, because it became it became contaminated with very fine fibers. And so it was a very non-efficient and not economical process. But the theory of putting filler inside the fiber was what caught my eye, and subsequently I built on that and said that we should have a chemical reaction that would occur within the fiber, and we could require much less filler, so we wouldn't have an excess of filler we have to screen out, and there would be no byproducts, and it would be able to release some of this non-freezing water, which is so difficult to remove from paper. So Tony Scallon really was an inspiration to me way back in the early 80s. So those two people, I think, were really influential in my life, in my professional life.
Um, I guess one thing that I had a question about was whether or not you had a chance to work with any students or faculty from the University of Wisconsin campus.
Oh, yes, I did. Ray Young's over in the forestry department, I took some courses from him, and I became fast friends with him, and he was very much very helpful to me. He was extremely helpful, and we collaborated on some joint projects together, and he did send students to work with me, so it was a very very productive relationship.
Now, did you see this relationship between the Forest Products Lab and the university campus? Was that prevalent throughout the Forest Products Lab?
Well, you know, initially when I came to work, the laboratory had money to give out. And then our collaboration with the university was much heavier than perhaps it is now because we had money. But as soon as our funds began to dry up, cutting, you know, the logging by the Forest Service was greatly reduced, and our budget, of course, was reduced as well. Then the collaboration wasn't as strong with the universities because we had no money to give them. We were looking for money, and the university was looking for money. So at times we would collaborate jointly, but it wasn't as much as when we could give the university money. So that was really, it was a question of money. And when our funds dried up, some of our projects did too.
Now, how many years did you spend at the Forest Products Lab?
How many years?
Yes.
I started in 1970, and I've been retired 2 years now. So in 2006, I started in 1970, so I was 36 years at the laboratory.
Okay. And over this span of 36 years, did you notice any changes in the lab, corporate culture, or general research strategies, or anything like that?
Well, as I said, we were not encouraged to work in teams when I first came there. Because they didn't know how to give credit for the publication, so they said you should have a sole author publication. Then we know who to give credit to. And the other thing was they didn't want us to go after grants, soft money, because we would hire in temporary people, and it was so traumatic to have to let them go because usually they didn't want to leave, and they were very good workers. But that all changed when we began to have a shortage of funds. They allowed us to work in teams because, after all, teams are more productive. If you publish one paper per year, and every scientist does that, say that you get a team of three people, you're going to publish more than three publications that year. You're going to probably publish five or six, at least, if not more. So it's more productive to work at teams. If you get the right type of teams when there isn't too much of an overlap in specialties, you know, it depends on the team. But most people would form teams where they would complement each other. For example, one person would be strong in statistics, one would be very good at hands-on doing experiments, one would be good at writing it up or writing for grants. And so, you know, that's the way you have a strong team. And then, you know, writing for grants, that was discouraged, but in the end it was very much encouraged. And if you could get grant money, you were sitting pretty and your project was in no danger of being cut. So those two things, you know, working in teams and running for soft money, that was a tremendous change. It was a 180-degree change, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Discouraged when I came and very much encouraged when I left. And I think, you know, when I first came there, there was a more, emphasis was more on applied research. And when I left, we were getting more into fundamental research. Not totally, but there was a stronger emphasis on fundamental research, which is good, but it always should be connected to some practical aspect, some applied aspect. You know, the best projects have both an wasn't applied in fundamental aspects to them, in my opinion.
Well, here's an interesting question about the relationship or how you perceive the Forest Service. How do you feel about having worked for an agency that's part of the U.S. Forest Service?
Well, the Forest Service, I love working for the Forest Service, and the Forest Service is a part of the USDA, and I believe that that's the proper place for us, a good place for the Forest Service to be. I think the USDA has a good record of research, and I think the laboratory does as well. You probably say, well, why did you retire? I was 74 years old when I retired, and I think I broke the record for age for a permanent full-time research, or retirement age. I don't think anybody's retired at a higher age at the laboratory, but that's not going to stand very long because it takes so long now to get a permanent job at the laboratory to get a decent retirement. I think the young guys are going to have to be working a lot longer than 74. I think we're going to have people working up into 80, which is, if they're still productive, there's no reason why they shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was a very good place to work, and if I had to do it again, I would.
Do you feel that your work has left a mark on the Forest Products Lab, the USDA Forest Service, or beyond?
Yes, I think so. I think it has. Especially if fiber loading goes, if it's successful in Germany this summer, I think there's going to be a tremendous effect on papermaking. Papermaking hasn't changed much in the last 50, 75 years, and this will be a dramatic change. All paper mills will adopt this. They'll either be retrofitted for this or the new paper machines will be made so much smaller and more efficient. It'll be a tremendous change, a very positive change.
Okay. Well, I would like to just open it up for if you have any stories, memories, or general comments about your time at Forest Products Lab that you would like to record and that kind of thing.
Well, just to sum up, I thought it was a very good place to work. I would work there again. The laboratory has several strengths, but one of the strengths is that they allow you to publish. If you were working for research in the private sector, they wouldn't encourage you to publish at all. They might allow you to, or they might not, but that would not be a big factor. And allowing a researcher to publish his results is a real big thing. The mission of the laboratory is just an excellent, excellent mission. It's to extend our forest resource, and then they give you the mission is so broad and so fundamental, and you're given so much flexibility, and you're able to direct your own research. It's just a wonderful, wonderful job. Nothing bad to say about it. That was a very good place to work.
Okay, well, those are all the questions that I have. If there's not anything else that you would like to add?
No, I can't think of anything.
Okay.
I think that pretty much covers it.
Okay. Well, I would love to thank you for taking an hour of your time to talk with me and
Just thinking about this, you would think that this is a little bit of a criticism. You would think that the Forest Service would have a very clear idea about how to manage the forests. They get a lot of input from every sector, from the public sector, from universities, from the industries, from everybody, the environmentalists, the industrialists. And they're pulled in so many different directions, and they all have some logic behind them. But it's very, very difficult for the Forest Service to have a clear idea, especially in the last 10 years or so. There's no real clear idea of how our forests should be managed. Mm-hmm. They said for a while, well, there will be no cutting, and then we ended up with these terrible forest fires. I mean, there's we didn't harvest, and therefore we had so much fuel on the floor that when we did get a fire, it would burn intensely, intensely hot. So that wasn't a good idea. So, you've got to, in my opinion, treat the forests as at least parts of them as a crop, and these should be harvested when they get to a certain age. They're mature trees. The next thing in stage would be for them to fall over and die, and rot, and not do anybody any good, be a source of fire hazard and insects and disease, and give off CO2 from decay. Mature trees should be harvested and young trees planted one way or another behind them. And yet the Forest Service doesn't really have a clear plan for how to manage our forests. And they're trying to be all things to all people, and I don't think that's really the answer. Mm-hmm. But it's a tough problem, seemingly a simple one, but it's a really difficult problem, and I hope that they'll be able to come up with a clear plan, shortly.
Where do you think the Forest Products Lab fits within the future of forestry in this country?
Well, I think that there's a real big push now to produce biofuels, ethanol from cellulose, and I think that's something that should be continued to be worked on. I think biofuels are going to be a big thing for the future. But on the other hand, even processes that are immature processes, and people say, for example, a little story, say a grandfather and his little daughter are crossing the street, and in the winter or in the spring like it is now, and it's all slushy, and the granddaughter says to her grandfather, Grandfather, I see a $20 bill sticking up from the slush in the street. And the grandfather says, no, it must be counterfeit, because if it was real, somebody would have picked it up long ago. And, you can say, well, some of these industries, like the paper making process, this is a very old process, there's nothing new to invent, and yet there is. And I think in fiber loading, there's going to be a big breakthrough. And so I think that there's, even in existing processes, we shouldn't give up on them. There's a lot of $20 bills laying around. All we have to do is pick them up. I'm not saying that we shouldn't get into new things like biofuels, but we should look at the existing industry and keep developing that as well.
Okay. Well, that's all I had, so...
Well, thank you very much for interviewing me. It was